bum bum bum. Adam.
Bum 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 bum. That's the new thing, so I'm sorry, Brandon.
Oh, sorry, Brandon.
Hey,
Adam.
Hey, Evan. How's it going?
How's it going?
Good evening. Good.
Hey, welcome back to Mythmakers.
Yes.
It's a podcast all about storytelling, the process, people, and power of story. So we talk about
power.
The power.
You were hitting power.
There's a lot of power in storytelling, don't you think? Wow. All right. Adam just turned into emo cat here for a minute. But,
exactly. No, most definitely. Most definitely.
Yes. So if you haven't tuned in before, this is the show that you're in for. Adam and I have together about 40 years experience developing, producing, creating story types of content.
Yep.
Kind of all over the place.
From
video games to live action film and television.
Some animation.
All kinds of fun stuff.
Yep.
So that's us, and we're gonna
Sunday night. We're a bottle of wine in,
as you can tell. So, couple of quick updates. So Yarn, our Dead Town series on Yarn, is up to 2.2 million total views at
this
point.
Great.
Which is pretty great.
Love that.
So we're excited about that. Season one and two are available now.
Season three is actually finishing up production on all the art for season three
and finishing up scripts for season four.
So a couple of weeks away.
So this whole Dead Town series on Yarn actually wraps up with season four. So that'll be out this month.
And that leads into some kind of Easter eggs, but it leads into essentially the comic series
Comic series, and we're talking about continuing in a slightly different format on Yarn as well. So we'll figure out, you know, exactly how that's all going to play out. But the story on Yarn is directly the precursor to the Macroverse comic series.
It's essentially the story we said we'd never tell.
It is,
and then kind of
Yarn
happened, and then it seemed like the right thing to do.
The right vehicle for this particular tale. Exactly. So that is up there right now, and you can check the show notes for a direct link right into the Yarn story, which is lots of fun. We will do an episode at some point where we talk about writing for Yarn, because it is an interesting format, and it does bring some of its own kind of considerations and thought processes to it.
It certainly does, and it brings its own constraints, but it's not, in a way, once you embrace those constraints, then it's a very freeing.
It's actually, I found it to be a kind of object lesson in embracing constraints in general. So it's like, you know, it's like once you just, as you said, it's like once you just kind of fully say, like, this is the way these stories need to be told, then there's actually a lot of creative freedom and actually sort of interesting, innovative things that I feel like we can do within that format, rather than fighting against that format.
It works incredibly well. And when it's working, it's fair. It's as compelling as anything else.
Yeah.
It's terrific.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we're actually very much in the thick of doing a bunch more stuff. On the Yarn platform as well. There hasn't been an official announcement yet, so we'll hold off on seeing exactly what that is.
Yep.
But through the rest of the year, there'll be a lot more
there'll be a bunch of us
on Yarn.
Don't let that put you off.
Yes.
It's going to be great.
It's going to be great. So this week's topic is scene blocking.
Yes.
Bring us into the world of scene blocking.
So this was very much inspired by the episodes that I've been shooting on Future Man this last couple weeks.
Future Man being
a Hulu TV show starring Josh Hutcherson and Eliza Cooper and Haley Joel Osment and bouncing to and fro a ton of sci-fi action comedy.
Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg, masterminding.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Really funny, great stuff. Loved it. Did the first season as well. Thoroughly enjoying season two. Very much hoping there's a season three. It's kind of great.
That I've seen anything from season two,
but I will say that
season one is hilarious and so much fun. And on Hulu right now. So while we are truly not paid to say that.
We are. No, truly not.
It is definitely a ringing endorsement.
Yes.
Yeah. Tonight's episode sponsored by Future Man.
Exactly. No. Actually, it was really funny. I had it when we were going on Katie and Brett's show it released.
Yeah.
I pinged Seth and Evan. I was like, hey, we're going on the show. Like, should I plug the show? Yeah. What can I do? They're like, yeah, say something nice and don't tell them we abused you. What's the advice? I was like, okay, ow, I still hurt.
That seems dangerous in this current climate of Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. That was great. But they didn't. I promise I won't do it again. I'm sorry. So working with a terrific director right now called Tamara Davis. She's got something like 150 music videos under her belt. Mm-hmm. She was married to Mike D from Beastie Boys. I mean, so 150 music videos, a few movies, 50 plus television episodes. Mm-hmm. I mean, she knows this thing backwards and forwards. And while being extremely talented, the big thing that jumped out at me with her is her ability to block a scene out efficiently. And the scene blocking, for anyone that doesn't know, is just simply, it's the movement of actors within a scene. And you can make that complicated or you can make that simple.
So just for anyone that doesn't know, like what, say specifically like the, in relation to, you've got a set, you've got some actors, you've got a camera. So, like, how does that all go together into
it? So, all right. So, let's see. It is, you are shooting a scene, and the two of Evan and I are talking about, we're brainstorming a new idea for a show, right? Yes. Now, there is the simple way of shooting that scene is that one of us walks in, and we sit down at a table kind of opposite each other, and then we discuss the scene. And the
traditional way, I throw wine in Adam's face and get up and storm out.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, you know, that is the simplest possible form of blocking that scene. Mm-hmm. So that would involve probably a master, some kind of wide shot of the room. We bring, you know, you would come in. We maybe kind of dolly around. We have end up with a kind of two shot, the two of us facing each other. And then it's essentially...
Right. So you can tell that Adam does this every single day. So what's a master?
Me.
Sorry, what's a master shot?
Me? I'm a very good shot. Well, sorry, no. Okay, so yes, thank you.
Yeah.
So, looking at a scene, you typically break it down into the master is a kind of big, wide establishing shot of a scene. So it sets the stage. It allows you to see the room, the environment in which the actors are operating in. You'll see all the blocking, so you'll see the blocking being, you know, the movement of the actors within it. So in this case, someone comes in and sits down, or they're more complicated, so one person's seated, another one is kind of circling the table. You know, you'll get it's the kind of establishing shot because it establishes the geography of the space in which we're operating.
Yes.
The geography scene. You typically don't live in the master for more than a few seconds before you get into coverage, which is then the closer shots that are more performance-based. Mm-hmm. So the master is typically about... It's about the movement.
Literally establishing, here's where we are, here's who's here, here's what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can move around within that to tell you more specifically, or to control the narrative inside of that setting.
Sometimes the master will be one long shot and you'll play the whole scene on the shot. So you might start with a master and then you can kind of push in closer and come into one kind of close up that then pans across and, you know, plays that out in that way. That becomes a stylistic choice.
Yeah. You also mentioned dollying around. So for anyone that doesn't know,
the dolly is the big, heavy camera platform that the camera literally sits on.
So it's like train tracks.
It's this big articulated machine. And there's an arm on the front of it. So the arm can go up and down, the dolly can move around, and the camera operator sits on the dolly operating the camera as it moves. And so it's this good dolly moves are beautiful things to behold because they're a combination of the camera operator and the focus puller, who is literally someone who, the first assistant camera, who stands to the side with this little kind of dial in his hand or her hand, literally making sure the shot is focused. And so the more complicated the move, the more that person has to work.
Yes.
And the lower the light, the shallower the depth of field and the lenses, which means the harder that person has to work. And so good camera assistants, good first ACs are incredible to behold. because they're hitting marks that you couldn't possibly, no normal person could hit.
Yes.
As these cameras move around. So then blocking wise, it's, so having had your master, let's say in that situation,
mm-hmm.
you know, Evan and I are sitting at a table, we have our master, it's a big wide look at the room, Evan walks in, he sits down, we talk, he throws one in my face, he goes out. So you would start with your big master, your wide shot, and then you would come into maybe a tighter two shot, which would be kind of Evan and I at either side of the frame, still mm-hmm. looking at each other.
Right.
Then you would get into traditional coverage, is then kind of over Adam to Evan, and then tighter single on Evan, and then if it's a drama, you might even go tighter still.
So over meaning camera.
You hold a piece
behind.
Of the
exactly.
Exactly. So the camera. Thank you. Sorry, it's just, the over is literally, well, an overshot is an over the shoulder.
Yep.
Literally means you are holding a piece of shoulder in the foreground of the shot as the person is looking at the next, at the person they are talking to. Mm-hmm. My very first job interview, funnily enough, I was interviewing for a director's assistant, and he asked me, you know, what's an over the shoulder? And I said, I have no idea. It's like off the cuff. I don't know what that means. I knew what the shot was.
Right.
I didn't know what the terminology was.
Right.
You know. And then you will typically kind of punch in tighter. So either you'll move the camera in. You can either just go longer lens. And the longer the lens, the more the background fuzzes out. Or you can push in on the person and go kind of wider and closer, which means you'll see more background. The face starts to get a bit distorted as you come in that way. You know, if you're shooting a comedy, you're typically not doing full close-ups. You're not, you know, you're kind of staying off the face. You're staying mm-hmm. in kind of a medium. If you're doing drama, you probably go at least one lens, if not two, closer. So you're really getting into the kind of eyes of the actor. And then you flip it around. So then if you've done kind of me to Eben and tighter, then maybe you turn around. Then you do Eben to me and tighter, and then that will cover all the footage you need for that scene.
And then you get the insert shot where Adam suggestively puts his hand on my knee.
Exactly.
And then that's the wine throw.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's happened so many times. So that would be the simplest possible way of covering that scene. Now, blocking is incredibly simple. A lot of times on TV shows, you want... What happens is you end up with scenes that are more complicated.
Yeah.
And then you have a lot of scenes that you need to kind of chomp through quickly. And so the more complicated scenes, then you will have a lot of camera movement, a lot more people. We've just spent two nights shooting this big kind of number on Future Man.
Yeah.
And we had, before that, we had a big party scene and an action sequence to shoot in that, which is lots of moving pieces and lots of running around. And so that, whereas kind of 2 to 3 pages of dialogue shot simply between two people can be done in 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any kind of action sequence or dance sequence or song or whatever it might be takes hours and hours and hours and hours to shoot, because you've got every single piece of it has to be mapped out and everything has to be then shot specifically to capture that piece of it. But so being able to block a scene simply and have actors, but still do it creatively. So, as opposed to Eben and I sitting at a table, maybe I'm standing in the middle of the room and Eben comes in and walks up behind me, and there's a shot with, you know, me in the foreground looking out, and then we rack focus and Eben's behind me, and then I turn around, and then you get into your kind of over coverage, and maybe that camera moves around, and then maybe there is some movement so that Eben walks away and I walk up to him, and there's another section of the scene that takes place in a different part of the room. That is more complicated blocking for the same thing,
mm-hmm.
because, very simply put, every time you move your camera and you change the axis of the coverage of production, of shooting, that adds shots and therefore time.
Yep.
On a TV show, when you're burning kind of between $8,000 and $12,000 an hour, every 15 minutes you're spending adds up quickly. Yes. And so what I've seen again and again is that kind of good directors know which scenes to take their time on, and then they know which scenes can be kind of blasted mm-hmm. through by keeping the coverage simple.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that it's dull, but
right.
you can do this kind of beautiful establishing shot that then pushes into a piece of coverage that you actually need. And if you keep the actors on one line, so in that situation, you know, Eben and I talk in the middle of the room, let's say you've got, you know, Eben comes in, he walks in behind me, you see that there's a I'm a kind of close to the lens, so it's a single on me with Eben behind, and then it rack focuses, which means the focus shifts from the foreground to the background, and then I turn around, that becomes Eben's coverage. And let's say Eben moves away a little bit, kind of walks off and then turns around later, and I go up and maybe take his mark. There's still then movement in that scene, but it's all on one line of coverage, which means the lighting can stay the same, which means you're not fighting, having to move. Whereas if Eben walks off and goes 90 degrees to where he was, I then have to shift by 90 degrees, which means that that line of coverage, either you then go to a two shot, or more likely, I have to come in and then you're covering not only that first bit of dialogue, me to Eben, Eben to me, but as that shifts, there's now a whole new axis that you have to cover, Eben to me, me to Eben, in a whole new way.
So the big thing is having to reset lights, having to reset camera.
Exactly.
So it's like as soon as you have to move stuff around, you're slowing down dramatically.
Exactly.
If you can figure out a creative way to tell the story without having to move stuff around and still keep things interesting.
Especially in television, that behooves you. And especially in low-budget filmmaking, that behooves you.
Yeah.
Learning how to shoot scenes quickly and then focus on what you want, what the meat of the movie or the show is, that is essential.
Well, this goes back, it's funny because we'll keep talking about the blocking in particular, but this goes back to a conversation we had about Terminator and some other, things in recent episodes where, I think there's this wonderful magic trick that directors are able to pull off with especially these sort of, lower budget but sometimes incredibly impactful movies or shows where it is that, very particular focus on, okay, I know if we really sell this big moment or these couple of kind of critical moments, like this is going to establish this world. It was in reference to Upgrade as well.
We talked about it specifically.
You know, there are these two or three scenes that are going to totally sell this is a big world. There's a lot of technology.
Exactly.
There's a lot of, effects, kind of sci-fi stuff going on here. But then the rest of it can be really, really simple because we've already got the audience believing in this world.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I think it's that similar kind of thought process, right? It's like, here are these things I can spend some extra time on, some extra money on. We're dealing with this ourselves on a slightly smaller scale with this yarn stuff that we're working on. It's like, here are these key things that we need to do to kind of sell this world. And then how do we kind of intentionally scale back some of the other stuff to make sure that we can still deliver everything.
Still deliver the story that we want to deliver without breaking the bank doing it, basically.
Yeah. Or the time.
All the time, exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, and that becomes the, and then this is also where what when it works well is when it becomes a kind of a joint conversation between director and writers.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you've got a scene that is three pages and there are five people in it and they're moving around and you've got specific beats that is, Henrietta walks over to the curtains and opens the curtain, appears outside and then comes back, and then Jonathan goes across and he opens the fridge door and then he comes back and then they go across the sofa and they sit down, that's going to take 8 hours to shoot.
Right.
Because you've got all these specific beats. So Henrietta goes to the curtain, appears outside and comes back is easy to shoot, except it takes Henrietta all the way across the room, which is a different line of access, and she peers out of the window, which means then you probably need to shoot a specific shot of what she's seeing out of the window, which may or may not be tied to the set you shoot it on, because you're probably shooting, if it's an interior room, you're shooting on a stage, and yet the view out of the window is of a real life street. So then you have to tie that one shot gets carried and gets shot specifically on a street at a different location.
Yes.
And then you have to have the camera outside the window looking in at Henrietta as she peers out.
Yeah.
Which is a whole other setup for a 2-second beat. And if that is crucial to the storytelling,
great.
Of course that needs to be done.
Yeah.
A lot of times and they just do this again and again, writers don't understand the impact of what they write in terms of its screen time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this constant sense of surprise, even with established, intelligent writers who've been doing this a long time. I didn't mean it to do that. I just thought it was kind of a nice little move. It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant.
Right.
There's a whole, I had imagined this being this little kind of mini story that played out between the cat and dog. Wait, if you have a cat and dog playing, like if it's not just a simple thing, you're doing coverage on that moment, which requires an extra 2 hours of filming.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of time reaction is, oh God, no, I didn't even think that. I was just, it was a funny beat. Let's cut that.
Right.
That becomes the conversation.
Yeah.
Or it's, you know what? No, we really need to do that. In which case, great, let's see, if we're taking time to do that, and we're serious about only shooting X number of hours, mm-hmm. well, then what are we giving up to get to that extra bit?
Yeah.
And that, because it's just become horse trading thing that happens. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of hammered home to me this week watching Tamara, working with Tamara, who has been so skillful in how to block scenes. And it's been kind of a masterclass in how to keep energy and how to shoot these beautiful sets that we have in the show, and play to the strengths of the cinematographer and play to the strengths of the actors and get through a lot of great looking footage and do it in a way that you're not shooting 14, 15 hours and burnt out at the end of it.
Yeah.
It's been fascinating, I think, and it hits me again and again, especially we talk about doing our own stuff and especially as we've, talked about the low budget movies or trying to mm-hmm. do this action. You're doing a low budget movie in 12 days and you have two big action scenes that are going to be the big crux of the movie. Well, then great. You want to spend 2 days a piece on those action sequences. Right. You better learn how to shoot at a TV pace, seven or eight pages a day for the rest of it. Yeah. And do that in such a way that you're telling your story and doing it mm-hmm. effectively and not breaking the bank and breaking mm-hmm. your cast and breaking your crew doing it.
Yeah.
And I think an upgrade was a great example of that, where it was mostly two and three people talking
mm-hmm.
in these great looking sets. Yeah. And then there were these big action beats and these couple of big set pieces, mm-hmm. the best set piece dramas, in the middle of it. And it was very, very skillfully done because of it, as we talked about before. And so much of that, again, it starts with the script, like the script has to be written with that in mind.
Yeah.
But then the director knowing how to do that is crucial. Knowing how to block scenes is crucial.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can take 2 hours doing something, or you can take 10 hours doing something.
Yeah,
And that is totally up for the director.
Yes. Well, I know you told me about commercial shoots you've been on where it's the 10 hours shooting the perfect frame
the perfect one shot. Yeah, exactly.
Of the Pepsi or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes. And if that's what's necessary, that's fine.
Yeah.
It's the bump happens obviously when people are expecting you to get the perfect shot that takes 10 hours to shoot and then 10 other perfect shots and yet do that in 12 hours.
Right.
That's where the disconnect is.
Yes.
And it's interesting.
Yeah.
It's fun.
It's interesting. I mean, it's a different animal entirely, but it makes me think of, as a way to promote some other cool thing that we've done, but also tie it in. So one of the Lemley pieces we've been working on is now playing in Lemley mm-hmm. Theater. So if you happen to be in Los Angeles and at a Lemley Theater as of a couple of days ago, if you happen to see an animated spot with a Dr. Franken-Lamb, or a Franken-Lamb's monster in this case, that will be something that we created. Very, very cool, and I haven't had a chance to see it in the theater yet, which is a little disappointing, but I'm sure I'll find a way to go see it in there. Always very cool to see anything that we've made actually playing on the big screen.
Oh my God, yes.
It makes me think of a, kind of correlation to animation or even to some of the comics work and other things we've done, which is, trying to be smart about the usage of the assets that we have, essentially. Yes. So in this Lemley spot, for example, it's very, very much based on the classic 1939, I believe, Frankenstein, Frankenstein mm-hmm. movie. And so there's a moment in the Frankenstein movie where the original film is a shot from the side of the monster. This is after Frankenstein has been, or the monster has been put up in the air and lightning has struck and he comes back down. Mm. And there's a shot from the side where his hand starts to kind of twitch and move.
Of course.
And then it's a different setup where you're looking kind of down at the monster. And then you have Dr. Frankenstein, kind of look at the monster, turn around to camera and say, it's alive, it's alive. The kind of mm-hmm. classic scene.
Absolutely great stuff. Yes.
So when we were figuring out how to create this animation, limited budget, limited time to get it done. We had originally come up with this way to do that, where essentially it's one long shot and the camera is panning up the body of the creature monster. In the animation. And they really wanted, you know, our client, Lemley, really wanted to get some, you know, kind of reference to the hand twitching. And you know, this had to be a conversation about, you know, it's like, great, if we create the shot that's in the film, then it is a new piece of art. It's a new right. setup. It's going to yeah. be more time, more money, you know, just much, much more complicated to get done in the time with the resources that we had. So, you know, can we find a way to do that within the same setup, within the right. same art, within mm-hmm. the same asset? And so we ended up doing that by doing a Dutch camera shot on the hand that was in the existing frame, do it as a close-up, right. make that twitch so you can add that animation, then cut to the wide so it still feels like a new setup. Two separate shots, but it's actually built off exactly. of the same assets and the same, you know, setup. Yes. And so I think it's, you know, it's that kind of thinking where I think, you know, hopefully will serve us well in all these things that absolutely. We're doing, where it's, you know, just creatively utilizing the resources and the assets mm-hmm. that you have. You know, we find that in the way that we approach some of the work in our, you know, Macroverse series as well. It's like, you know, here are these shots that we know we want to do. So it's like, you know, can we repurpose this background or this, you know, couple of different pieces to make something feel different, even though it's actually built off of the same assets, or to kind of tell the story in a slightly different way so that you're utilizing these same pieces in a way that still feels exciting and interesting and not repetitive.
Yes.
So I think it's, you know, it's that kind of stuff. I think, you know, especially when you're dealing with some, you know, kind of lower budget, quicker turnaround kinds of things mm-hmm. that, you know, finding kind of creative solutions to those problems can still absolutely deliver a great experience.
Well, that's the thing.
But, exactly. you know, be smart about the exactly. resources that are available.
And it's, you know, there's something, there's one of those things. I think it's the couple of things there, but it's the, you know, most audiences don't know what they're not seeing.
Right.
So
yes.
this because you planned this amazing shot that comes all the way right. up Frankenstein's nose and through his veins. That, if it works,
yes.
they
great.
Know that yeah. and yeah. it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And secondly, in terms of reusing assets, there's a kind of equivalent in live action, yeah. which is when actors take each other's marks mm. in a scene because mm-hmm. you've already got lighting for one angle, one right. mark. If they take those, that if they just swap places mm-hmm. there, mm-hmm. It's actually got a name. It's called a Swedish replacement
mm.
because Ingmar Bergman would do it all the time mm-hmm. in his movies because it's an incredibly efficient way of
right.
shooting a
right,
scene.
Right, right, right.
So someone paces the room and then comes back to their same mark, or someone walks again. If you know, Evan and I are talking to each other, Evan walks past me and I then turn around and I take a step back and he then faces the room and mm-hmm. then comes back to my original mark.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Nothing has changed. Lighting yes. rise. It's an incredibly easy way of doing it, but you've still got, mm-hmm. you've added some dynamism and some movement and some pacing yeah. to the scene.
I mean, actually,
it wasn't there before.
In that Frankenstein sequence, actually, it's like, it's kind of brilliantly and effectively done where you do have those couple of shots, but they get so much mileage out of the one sort of, you know, kind of semi wide shot of the monster and Dr. Frankenstein right. with the monster, and then him turning around, coming into a close-up.
Yes.
And doing the it's a lot of
turning into
moment,
his own close-up, you know? Stepping yeah. into yeah, a close-up exactly. is a wonderful
yeah.
way of shooting it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. And so no, you get a lot correct. Of kind of dynamic action in that one
right.
shot.
Of course.
Yeah, great.
You know, and you look at old movies, tended to be masters of mm-hmm. doing that because
yeah.
they would, because they had slower lenses, slower mm-hmm. film.
Yeah.
And hotter lights.
Yes.
Everything took
yeah.
more time and expended more resources.
Yeah.
So they had to find ways to shoot this stuff
yeah.
effectively.
Yeah. Yeah.
And things like stepping into your close-up from a master was a great
yeah.
way of doing that
yeah.
and getting that wonderful depth and production
yeah.
value behind
yeah.
you
mm-hmm.
While it's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Good stuff. So let's
great
go
stuff.
Block some scenes.
Oh my God. Yeah. yep. Yep. Yep.
Yes.
What
in the world is a Hoojima flip?
I've forgotten. I have no idea. It's a thing.
Sounds about right.
It's
yeah.
a something. Exactly. It's whatever is top of the mind at the moment.
Yes.
What would you say yours is?
So mine for this week is an unexpected one, since this is news from a couple of days ago. But I am quite excited and happy to hear that Sir Patrick Stewart is stepping back a national treasure indeed, is stepping back into probably his most famous role as Captain Jean-Luc Picard of the USS Enterprise, although we don't know if it will be of the USS Enterprise.
Yes.
But very exciting. So new CBS Star Trek show. At first I was like, okay, he's going to be on Star Trek Discovery when I first read it. But rereading the article, realized, no, they're talking about a new Star Trek series also on the CBS streaming platform. This might actually get me interested in subscribing because I am a big fan of Star Trek The Next Generation. I think that iteration of Star Trek is probably my favorite Star Trek. And
it was the least boring of the Star Trek.
Well, I actually like most of the Star Treks. I'm not a big Deep Space Nine fan, but I think
never seen an episode.
Yeah, see, this is one of the few problems. But Next Generation, I think, is my favorite. I like classic Trek quite a bit. I watched a lot of it when I was a kid. I came to appreciate it more actually after getting into Next Generation. Mm-hmm. But I've probably seen every episode of Star Trek Next Generation.
Interesting.
And a lot of them multiple times. And I think it is one of the best. No, I think it's the best Star Trek. I think it's one of the best sci-fi series actually
it's certainly,
of all time.
As much as I ridicule it, it's intelligent sci-fi.
It's incredibly intelligent sci-fi. Yeah. And I think, wonderful performances, lots of incredibly good thinking about, how things... the implications of things,
right.
the ways that people, interact with each other, consequences, just lots of thinking and in a weird way, kind of moral parables and, all kinds of, good stuff in those episodes and in the series as a whole. And, the little bit that I know just anecdotally about, Patrick Stewart's journey and that, it's like he had been incredibly, he'd been a working actor for years and years and years,
yes.
But that was definitely his kind of breakout screen role.
Because he'd been at the RSC for a decade or so before.
Exactly.
That, yeah.
So, very well respected actor, but this was the thing that kind of made him known to, audiences around the world. The other interesting thing about Star Trek Next Generation is it's one of the few, and I think one of the last shows that didn't actually get produced with a network. It was produced for syndication.
Oh, really?
And as a result, the people that made it became very, very wealthy. Huh. But that means that it wasn't pitched and sold to, CBS, for example. It was shot specifically by the production company,
right.
And then syndicated to different channels around the country.
Wow.
Around the world. And so as it became more popular and successful, the production company made all of the money from that, as opposed to it being owned by a studio. So it's essentially licensed. So I don't think those deals really exist anymore. I'm sure they don't exist anymore, but it was
Charlie Sheen did his... After Three and a Half Men, he did that 100 episode run.
That's true. Yeah.
What the hell was that?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I know what you're talking
that
about.
One,
but
you know
yes.
What I mean? But no.
Yeah. But very, very, very rare.
Rare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that was the thing that I think I may be mistaken, but I think from what I remember, Next Generation kind of put that on the map as like, oh, this can be incredibly lucrative.
Hmm.
Of course, as a result, everyone did very well.
Yes.
So for me, very excited to just kind of see what that is. I read a great quote from Patrick Stewart today saying that, he had thought that, that part of his life was over, and he was actually surprised how excited he is to kind of come back to the role, which, of course, as a fan, makes me even more excited. So
that's very cool. It'd be nice to see him do that. I mean, there's a couple of Star Trek movies, First Contact being the big one, which is a great movie, and he was obviously leading that.
Yeah.
But I think I've seen the pilot of Next Generation.
Yeah. I don't think the movies do it justice at all. I think the show is head and shoulders better than the movies.
Well, I was going to say, the First Contact was really good. Then there was like Insurrection and something else, which were both pretty awful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yes.
Yeah. But I think, you know, the show, to me, the show holds up. It's worth going and seeking out it even now. Like, it's worth watching. And I actually suspect it's something that if, you know, Kyler in particular could kind of get into, I think he might like. But
interesting. Yeah. Okay, we'll have to watch one of that. It's very good. Because I don't think he's ever really seen it. We've seen the movies, the recent Star Trek movies, but he's never watched one of the classics.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
Raised on Star Wars.
Yes, which, of course, I am a Star...
But of course, I am a
Star Wars fan, first and foremost.
As much as I mocked your geek credibility in the last few months.
Yes, I know.
You know, Star Wars fan, obviously, eye to eye.
Yes.
Yes.
And for you, sir.
I'm taking Kyla to see... Empire Strikes Back on Thursday.
Yes.
At the Poly Bowl.
Well, there's
with a live orchestra.
There's my credibility gone. Very jealous.
Empire is the wrong one. But there's a New Hope playing as well.
There is, yes. Yes.
She's five.
I mean, I saw Star Wars when I was about that age.
I was about four, and bits of it scared me, but it was so good. And the bowl is such a great place.
Yeah.
See it.
And it's true. When is that coming out?
This, like, Wednesday and Friday.
Oh, is it New Hope as well?
It's a New Hope. They got New Hope, and then they've got Empire.
Yes.
They don't have Return.
I think it's a yearly thing, right? We'll probably... we're not going to make it this week.
Right. Yes, no.
Anyhow. Very Tyler jealous.
And I will be there.
Very
we'll
jealous.
Send you lots of
yes,
pictures.
Yes, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll expect some na-na-na-na-na text.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Totally. 100%. Yep. For me, definitely Hooch and Flip is Mission Impossible, the new one that we saw yesterday.
Yeah. Insurrection? No, we just say Star Trek Insurrection.
Star Trek Insurrection. It's not Rogue Nation.
It's Infidels. It's
Turnout. It's, Burnout.
Yep, something like that.
Something like that.
Mission Impossible.
For God's sake. Fallout.
There we go.
Mission Impossible Fallout.
Yes. Mission Impossible, the one that broke Tom Cruise.
The one that broke Tom Cruise. That one that cost us like $20 million produced because of the breaking of Tom Cruise.
Yes.
The entire production went down for like 8 weeks while he recovered. Yes. It's pretty spectacular. I don't think it is as good a movie as either Rogue Nation or Ghost Protocol. Mm-hmm. I think both of which worked incredibly well.
Yes.
It's a blast and it works. It's great. And it's got some really good moments in there, some genuinely powerful stuff going dramatically. And then it's more... They're all, obviously, they all revolve around these action set pieces. This is a little more frenetically paced than the other ones. And I think that is a criticism, not a praise, because it just... I'd love it. You could take a bit more of a breath between chases.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so indestructible that it starts to defy...
Logic,
and therefore remove some of the stakes. That
interesting,
you
yeah.
Having said that, motorcycle chase through Paris, going round the Arc de Triomphe counterflow, like going against traffic around the Arc de Triomphe, is kind of amazing and kind of hair-raising.
Right.
And little beats that I thought were so well done, where like he looks over his shoulder to see who's following and turns back and then swerves to avoid a car that's like stopped in the road. You know that was all meticulously planned,
yes.
And yet those little elements add so much tension because you're like, oh God, this could go wrong.
Well, you know it's meticulously planned, but also real.
But also
like,
real.
That's
it's
crazy.
Him.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's like him with no helmet driving through cars. And there is, you know, I was actually rewatching the Matrix Reloaded motorcycle piece in the freeway.
Yeah.
And that's a spectacular sequence.
Yes.
And it doesn't compare to these last two. Yeah, I think... Rogue Nation had an amazing one.
Mm-hmm.
This one, I think, just goes on a little bit too long, and it's still amazing. And then it gets one-upped with the bloody helicopter chase, which, again, is Tom Cruise driving a helicopter,
flying
a helicopter around the skies and crawling around underneath, clearly. And that's what's amazing. And, you know... He's underneath the helicopter, and there's a camera there, and he's just swinging around. And you know he's tied in.
It
doesn't
it's
matter.
Still him.
It's still a bloody helicopter. And then you've got Superman, what's his face? Who's great.
Mustachioed,
exactly.
Henry Cavill,
Henry Cavill, exactly. Who's actually really good.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. And again, you're in a helicopter and he's being thrown around the place, and there's no question that he's in this chopper being thrown around the place,
right.
looking genuinely scared a number of times. You know, so it's impressive.
Yes.
And then the skydiving thing, which I believe they've shot like 50 times
to get it right,
the halo jump.
Yeah.
It's this incredible shot where like, you pan, he's at the edge of the thing, he looks over, you kind of pan with him as he goes back, he psychs himself up, and then the camera, he kind of runs towards camera, and the camera flies out of the plane ahead of him, he falls forward into this close-up, and then he kind of backs off, and then he goes past camera, and you follow him around as he's going to grab somebody else. And it's just spectacular.
Speaking of blocking. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Exactly. He's flying into his own close-up. He's just falling out of an airplane. And you can see why they shot it so many times.
Right.
But it's amazing.
Yes.
And I'm just always kind of in awe of Tom Cruise in these movies.
Yeah.
However, whatever nuttiness there is in the Scientology of it all,
he's still amazing. Yeah.
Really impressive.
Yeah.
And he knows how to pull it off. And there's a bunch of kick-ass women in this as well, which was kind of great
cool.
to see.
Yeah.
So, it's good stuff. Good
That's
authority
cool.
was
no,
saying,
I,
and Chinese was amazing.
I think I mentioned to you, I don't think we talked about it on the show, so I want to caveat this with saying this came from the internet, so the veracity of it is highly questionable, but...
Set in stone, that's what you mean, I think. I saw it in one of Donald Trump's tweets, so it must be true.
Okay, it must be true. So, I read that, so number one, you've noticed that in every Tom Cruise movie, he is a pretty impressive runner,
yes.
right? So it's like, he's got a good movie run.
Oh,
right?
God, yeah.
And one of the things that that this article I read talked about is, you probably also noticed that he runs with scissor hands, right? So it's like straight fingers out,
it's hands. It's blades, it's not fists.
Yes. Blades. So apparently that's a incredibly intentional choice. And this does kind of vibe with my impression of him in particular, and that, he seems to be very aware of how he is shot, what the camera is picking up, the halo jump being a good example of that, that apparently when someone is running with fists, that motion is not captured as well in film, that the action is, kind of more of a blur essentially. And that when you do the straight hand, the scissor hand or whatever you want to call it, that is more easily actually seen as an action by the camera. So that's apparently why he does that. The second thing, which is, I think, again, completely not fact-checked, but I think an interesting potential anecdote, is that apparently the more Tom runs in a movie, the better the box office.
Well, interesting.
So
that would play out of this, because there's a whole sequence, right? And this actually started to piss me off, because it was like, oh, enough of him running already.
Right.
It's like there's this whole chase of him running through London.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, hey, he's running through this picturesque piece of London.
Yes.
And then he's running across this picturesque bridge with Tower Bridge. Right? And then he's running out for Tate Modern.
Yes.
And he's
yes.
It's a lot of running.
And this one is breaking box office records. So that may in fact seem to play out. So I think we can all look forward to the next Mission Impossible movie, where he's undercover as a marathon runner has to go from one end of Germany to Russia or something like that.
It's gonna be marathon.
It's gonna be marathon man with Tom Cruise. Run Forrest, Run with Tom Cruise. Yeah.
So, anecdotally, have you heard the conversation that took place between Dustin Hoffman and Laurence Olivier on Marathon Man?
No, I don't know.
So Laurence Olivier, obviously very classically trained, came out of ROC, Dustin Hoffman, the polar opposite.
Royal Shakespearean Company, by the way.
Sorry, yes. Dustin Hoffman, the polar opposite in terms of being, very method, very into it, and having to give it to, and so gearing up for some scene, and he's running around, and he's getting himself worked up, and Laurence Olivier apparently said, "Have you tried acting?" Which is wonderful.
That's hilarious.
Yes,
very good.
You can see Patrick Stewart saying the same thing.
Absolutely.
It's great.
It's very good.
Yeah.
Very, very good. Well,
that's
our show for this week.
Yep.
So, as always, you can find us all over the social medias at
M2Action.
M2Action. You can please download the Macroverse app, which is our vision for the future of comics.
Mm-hmm.
So that's at Macroverse on both the App Store and Google Play. You can also find a link to that in the show notes. You can also follow what we're up to with Macroverse at Macroverse App on Instagram and Facebook. You can also find us on Instagram TV at M2Action and pretty much everywhere at M2Action.
Exactly.
We've got a lot more stuff coming up, so stay tuned. And if you're at all inclined, definitely check out our Dead Town series on Yarn as well. There's lots more to come there, as we talked about.
Lots of fun.
That link is also in the show notes. So all this stuff will be in the show notes if you access that via whatever you're listening to. It makes a huge difference to us and to this show if you will take a moment and rate and review
this. Rate it, review, and subscribe.
Wherever you are listening, please do so. It really does help other people find the show.
Yep.
Makes a difference to us and what we're up to. So thank you, as always, for listening. Our intro and outro is by the phenomenally talented... by Adam, and then also by our long-term collaborator and composer, Brandon Weisel. His link is also in the show notes.
You know, if you feel the need to augment the genius...
Think of it less as augmenting and more as collaboration.
It's more as, dear God, shut up. Don't do that again. Please. Right,
so... We'll start with Adam's outro, and then we will move on to Brandon's.
Exactly.
Sir.
No, I'm feeling insecure now. I'm feeling, yes. No. Yeah, there we go. Bye.